Hello and welcome to the Leadership Learned podcast, brought to you by the Inspirational Development Group. Each episode, we examine the behaviour, skills and attributes required to improve human performance through effective leadership. We discuss the latest thinking and issues affecting leadership from the boardroom to the classroom to provide you, whether you're a CEO, manager, graduate or student, with tangible insights to take away and use in your career and workplace as we go beyond the clichés to prove that leaders are made, not born. This episode, we're talking about human performance in a business context. And what we mean by that are the things that drive and motivate people to perform. We've been doing our own research into this over the last year or so, and it may not surprise you to hear that it is a poor leader who relies on paychecks and bonuses to motivate their people. What you may not be fully aware of are what those other factors are that are just as important. And in order to get optimum performance, how to measure them, develop them, and use them to achieve better organizational performance. We go into all the detail of this in the podcast, where we talk about how people are made to feel on a daily basis holds much greater value for them, even though they may not fully realize it. We discuss the hugely important role of well-being and how to develop it without losing focus on the business side of things and while still satisfying all stakeholders. What businesses who rely on financial incentives can do, and how to focus on the intangibles in our new remote working world. I'm your host, Matthew Moore, and this week, the leadership experts joining me are Nigel Girling and Dr. Rona McKenzie. Nigel has almost 40 years' experience serving in the boardrooms of organizations across multiple sectors. He was CEO of the National Center for Strategic Leadership, is a former member of the Government Task Force on Employee Engagement, and is an ambassador of the Chartered Management Institute. Nigel also used to be a professional guitarist who played on stages all over the world. Rona has more qualifications than we have time to mention here, but they include a doctorate in education, a master's in special education, a master's in business administration, and a level 7 diploma in strategic management and leadership. She was a school principal before moving into industry and has had various board level roles, including COO of a luxury jewellery brand and director of BD at a cybersecurity company. Rona is also chair of the Zest Theatre Company in Lincoln. Hello, guys. Are you all right?
Very well, thank you.
Yes. After that, how could we not be?
Good. So this week we're talking about human performance. Nigel, what do we mean when we talk about human performance in a business context?
Yeah, no, there's a short question with a very long answer. Probably the place to start is to say what we don't mean. What a lot of people take from human performance, if you Google it or other search engines are available, if you search on it, you'll find millions of hits, almost all of which will be to do with sport or sleep and nutrition. And clearly those things are all important, but that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about human performance in terms of how well can people perform in their jobs, in their work, in their lives. So we've done a lot of work on this. I've been doing lots of research into this for what seems like 1,000 years, trying to find out what it all means and what all the bits are that fit together. And we've kind of ended up at a point now where we've recognized that there are three main arenas of this that intersect, and that point of intersection is important. What we're talking about really is the place where you get the intersection between behavior, capability, and well-being. Now, each of those things is explored in great depth all over the world in different organizations and different spheres. But as far as we can tell, very few people are actually recognizing that these things actually interrelate very closely. So if you search on well-being, you'll get loads and loads of stuff about well-being, but none of it will talk about leadership or about management interaction or about behavior and capability. We're kind of working in that sweet spot that brings these three things together.
So is it fair to say that before we get into the meat of those three things, that a lot of development programs just concentrate on the capability aspect of things?
Absolutely. Or on the behavior aspect, depending on who's running it. So if you get a company that sells psychometric assessments, they'll view all of it through that behavioral lens. And what you tend to find happens, and I've been frustrated by this for decades, is that whatever field somebody works in, which is usually a part of one of these fields, they will see everything and respond to everything in that lens. So whatever the question is, something in that little area will be the answer, which clearly isn't the case, not scientifically or literally or psychologically. So yes, it's about It's about understanding that the borders between those countries, and most organizations live in one town within one of those countries, let alone the country itself. So,
So you talked about the sweet spot at the intersection between capability, well-being, and behavior. So what is that sweet spot?
Yeah, that's the trillion-dollar question. Therefore, I'm not going to give it away for free. Anyway, it's way too complicated to explain. But broadly speaking, this is about brains. This is really about brains, how brains work and how brains are affected by influences. So, you know, people's behavior comes from the way they think, the way they've learned to think, the kind of personality preferences that they exhibit, the kind of habits they've formed and the lessons they've learned, and maybe the people they've admired and sought to emulate. And there comes their behavior. And that behavior will therefore have an effect on everybody they ever touch. You know, if they manage somebody, lead somebody, if they lead an organization, if they have influence over the way somebody else thinks and feels, all of that stuff will play out, you know. And then the capability bit, you're right, you know, most management training, in inverted commas, tends to focus on that capability bit. Here's how to do something. Mm-hmm. Well, the trouble with learning how to do something is you're going to do it like that other bit.
Yeah.
You know, with all of your preferences and perceptions and attitudes and mindsets and all those kind of things. And then when we get to the well-being bit, there's the whole thing about how you feel, how people feel. Now, the way somebody behaves and the way and the things somebody's learned, the capabilities they've developed, affect the way they feel. They're not three separate things. So when people talk about well-being, they often, what they're talking about is, you know, programs that they run, like they'll put bike sheds at the back of their offices so that people can cycle to work. Or one other friend of mine who works in this field exclusively talks about bikes and bananas. Now, most organizations, that's what they've done, is they put out fruit bowls and encourage people to ride their bicycle. And those things matter. They are important too, but they're such a tiny little piece of what we're talking about here. They're not even, you know, 1% of it. Mm. So when we talk about people's well-being, we're talking about their mental wealth, how strong and robust they feel, how resilient they are, how capable they are of withstanding difficulties and obstacles and setbacks. You know, a lot of people these days talk about resilience, but what they're mostly talking about is how much rubbish can you put up with? And organizations love resilience because it means they can be horrible to their people and they'll get away with it. That's not what we're talking about here. Yeah. So the point of intersection really is in people's heads.
Yeah.
You know, that's where all their knowledge has been accumulated. That's where their behavior and personality and mindsets and attitudes plays out, and that's where their well-being is created. Because our well-being typically is a mental response to how we feel about things.
Yeah.
And we're talking about this, it's important to remember, from the point of view of leadership, because that's what we do. So when we talk about human performance, we're talking about human performance leadership. We're talking about the way leaders affect other people's behaviors, capability, and well-being, and the ones they exhibit themselves. Lots of us will have worked at some time for somebody that we wished would fall under a bus. Sometimes, in my case, I've been that person that other people wanted to fall under and would have tried to push, given half a chance, because of the way they make us feel.
Yeah.
Now, I've worked in jobs with people who made me feel uncomfortable and poorly ready to serve and poor in my own head in terms of my own emotional responses, etc., just because of the way they behaved and what they represented.
Yeah.
I've long had a problem with some of the programs we have on the telly, like things like Dragon's Den, where we sort of suggest that success means being a hard so-and-so who's accumulated lots of money. Mm. Now, that was never the version of success that I aspired to. To me, success is about being happy and proud of what you've done.
Yeah.
Again, there's massive quantities of stuff we could go into there. But broadly speaking, we're talking about neuroscience, I guess, really cognitive neuroscience, the way people's brains work. Some people, when faced with major setbacks, view them as an interesting challenge and an opportunity to be on their toes and do their best work. Other people could see even quite a minor setback as an absolute disaster that sends them running in the opposite direction. That all happens in your head. Mm. I'm now pointing at my head. Nobody can see me, but anyway, I can't help it. So, you know, leadership actually happens in people's heads. It happens in the head of the leader, and it happens in the head of the led.
Mm.
And this, what we're looking at here is that whole area of what affects those things, what shapes the response that people have, what shapes the way they feel about their leader, their team, their organization, their work. I worked in some of this in the engagement task force that you alluded to earlier, but that was looking at one bit. Now, my life's work has largely been about trying to stop people from looking at one bit and see the bigger picture,
yeah.
See how things interrelate.
Mm.
You know, I was involved in an organization called the Joined Up Thinking Organization 30 years ago, trying to do exactly this, try and get people to see that these things all interrelate. They're all joined up.
The financial thing, I think, is interesting as well, because when you're talking about the joined up thinking, a lot of leadership, a lot of leaders think it all relates to finances, in that if they want to get better performance out of someone, you pay them more, you give them a bonus, yeah. you give them a pay rise. But the research doesn't really stack up with that, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, when you look at the idea of trying to get loyalty from mercenaries, that's unlikely to work. You know, we know that's unlikely to work. And we've seen it in organizations in recent years more than ever, probably, that just paying people more money, you're buying the wrong bit of them.
Mm.
Yeah. And therefore someone else can come in and outbid you and they'll buy them instead. That's not helpful. We want people to be committed to something because it matters to them, not because it can buy them a better car. Mm. You know, in my career, I've had lots of nice cars, lived in some very nice houses, but it's always been compensation for the fact that actually in my head, it was not good. I wasn't proud of what I was doing. I wasn't enjoying what I was doing. I didn't feel like the best version of myself. So those things were compensations. I gave myself those things or acquired those things from employers because it made me feel like maybe it was worth it after all. But it wasn't really.
The financial side is, you know, is the bit that we're conscious of. So we're conscious of what we get paid and how many hours we work and whether we have to travel or, you know, all of those scenarios. But the unconscious part is the most powerful part, because how we're made to feel on a daily basis holds much greater value, but we don't consciously think about it all the time. So if we think about leaders almost interacting with their colleagues and affecting their batteries. So I always think of people have these internal batteries that get topped up and drained. And actually, bananas and bikes aren't going to top up my internal battery. But colleagues who are aware of the pressures and the time frames and the multiple roles or responsibilities we have and that work collegiately and so on and so forth, they affect our internal batteries. The salary is irrelevant, actually, at the end of the day. And that's why we see people leaving jobs irrespective of pay, because more of conditions. And by that, I don't mean whether you've got a nice desk and a comfy chair, but you know, the conditions within which we work with our colleagues on a daily basis and how we're made to feel all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, Rona, thinking back to your career, how critical that stuff is to students in a classroom.
Yeah.
If they don't feel like learning, they're not gonna.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Doesn't matter what you do, doesn't matter any detentions you dish out or disciplinary actions you take, they're just not gonna. And that's human nature. You know, human performance is based on human nature and our understanding of human nature. People, although circumstances shift and you know, the climate within a country or an organization or the world shifts, basically people are just the same as they ever were. They respond to the same stimuli as they ever did. They are a human being.
Mm.
Yeah. And we forget that at our peril, I think. And organizations often do things that completely overlook human nature, like bullying people. We know that doesn't work.
Mm.
We know that that actually produces negative consequences. And that it tells you far more about the bully than it does about those who are being bullied.
Mm.
We know that stuff. And yet still, organizations will promote people who are tough and dynamic and are good at that stuff. Yeah, because it's a lot easier, just like the pay thing. You know, if you pay people bonuses, it's a lot easier than having to lead them properly.
Yeah.
Much simpler.
If we think of kind of lots of these behaviors are looking at the short termism, kind of so the short term gains rather than the long term success. So where we see businesses where there's high turnover of staff, so they might be very successful, but they're churning through people to get to their intended goal, actually that long-term success isn't going to exist. And people start to get wise that this doesn't look like a business that I'd like to stay with. And I also think people have moved from the, I'll just put up with this for a bit of time because it will advance my career, and realized that, yeah, this one life that we have, the length of it is unknown. So let's not take that risk of being miserable for a period of time for a hopeful longer term benefit, because we don't know what that long term looks like.
Yeah. And we already see some of the fallout of that now. You know, that there's a generation or two coming that don't subscribe to this view of how life should be. They're not prepared to exchange their well-being and their enjoyable life for some cash. In some cases, they don't have to because they still live at home with their parents and somebody else is paying the bills, and they're never going to leave, by the way, guys, in case you were wondering. But also because they don't have the same kind of hit parade of priorities that, for example, I had when I left school in 1872. It was, you know, it was a very different thing. The only way you could put food on the table and exist was to go out and exchange your time for money. And that's still true for lots of people, but it's not true for everybody.
I think there's a really, I was listening to Simon Sinek talking a couple of weeks ago on a podcast, and he was saying that whilst there's the real benefit that current Gen Zs are less accepting of workplaces where they don't feel that they can thrive and perform, actually some of that inability to accept it can result therefore in a number of jobs where they never get the opportunity to get in and embed and develop skills and capabilities and learn and grow, so that they develop as people. It becomes a bit too short term and a bit flip floppy. And so whilst we can see a good reason for not accepting a workplace where it's not, you're not going to thrive, on the flip is, how resilient are you? What are you prepared to put up with actually is perfectly tolerable? And there's a real balance there. And I think leaders today need to be aware of both, so that they create the conditions whereby their employees, their colleagues are well, that their behaviours and capabilities are being developed, but at the same time, not making it so nice, inverted commas, that actually we're pandering to people's needs. We're here. It sounds a bit hard, but actually we're there to run a business and to be successful collectively, to achieve a common goal, a shared goal. It won't be easy all the time. Where do we draw the boundaries? I don't see it as like hard lines, but more as, yeah, kind of wibbly wobbly lines of how things flex and grow depending on. But there is an interesting balance there.
Yeah. And that sort of comes back to that whole mental toughness thing again, doesn't it? That we are, in recent decades, in the more prosperous nations, not everywhere by any means, but in the more prosperous nations, people are growing up in a level of comfort and support in many cases that was unknown to their grandparents. Even at the end of their careers and lives, they didn't have that kind of stuff. You know? And so levels of expectation have been shaped by that kind of thing. And you're right. The opportunity to build up scar tissue, limited. And one of the things we find with measuring people's mental toughness, which is kind of a plastic trait, so it can be changed and learned and developed, but it has a natural place, a level, based on the lives people have led and how their heads work, how their personalities are, all those kind of things we alluded to before. And the difference between someone who is mentally tough and someone who is mentally sensitive is massive in terms of their response to the same circumstance. And we see it, you know, you've seen it in classrooms where the difference in the behavior between them is complex, but, you know, it has roots in all of those things. Yeah. And it isn't necessarily to do with what's just happened. It's to do with their response to what's just happened. And so this is an area that if organizations were to get to grips with it, then start to recognize what the impact is of leaders' behaviors, capabilities, attitudes, mindsets, etc. And things like maybe their social and emotional intelligence, whether they're able to actually judge this stuff and adapt these things, is massive in terms of their successful achievement. For me, one of the things that's critical in all this is the stakeholder model. In organizations, whilst they know they have multiple stakeholders, there's definitely a hierarchy. Shareholders and regulators will be right at the top, and usually ahead of customers will come further down the list. Employees will be way down. if they're on the list at all. Suppliers be even lower down because they're slaves and we can abuse and ruin them and then go and find some others. You know, in lots of organisations, that's still the way they think. They talk about partnership, but don't really mean it. You know? But the stakeholder thing, if organisations can really get to grips with the fact that they've got multiple stakeholders and they have to satisfy the needs of all of them to their best available line of fit, you know? The leaders are usually incentivized, motivated and judged on satisfying one or two of them. If we got better at recognizing that actually a leader's impact on their people has a far greater, going back to your point, Randy, a far greater medium to long-term impact on the success of the organization than whether they hit this month's bonus target. That's just bribery. That's not what we're talking about.
What I found really interesting about the work you've been doing is it's helped me as a leader to consider the role of well-being, the role of my behavior and my capability, and firstly understand who am I, how do I show up, what kind of leader am I, what behaviors do I typically exist, kind of catching myself doing things that I do all of the time and noticing them and then looking at, so what's the impact of when I do that thing on other people, how capable am I, where am I, where's the gaps in my capability, where's the weak spots, do they need to be developed or actually is this okay, and then how well am I and what's the difference in my behavior when I'm fully charged up in my batteries and when they're depleted, and noticing that. So not saying that the battery's got to be full 24/7, but just watching myself for when my well-being is weakened, and what does that mean, and what do I need to top that back up, and what drains me or what energizes me. Because then once I've started to look at me, then I can look at my colleagues and then say, okay, now I'm look at the people I work most closely with. How do they typically behave? Well, you know, how well are they? What do I do that impacts on them positively or negatively? How might I be different? And so I feel like with the human performance leadership, we start with ourselves and get to know ourselves really well. And then we look out to those closest to us and do this very openly. So it's not like a behind the scenes covert operation to work everybody out, but actually it's talking to people and saying, firstly, acknowledging that X makes me a bit grumpy, or when that happens, I don't think I'm my best self. So that's okay. And now what might I do differently, or what might other people help me to do differently? And then kind of roll that out like ripples. When you drop a stone in a pond, the ripple effect on other people, and then they have their own little, you know, stone dropping ripples that affects lots of other people. So, and I think the reason that businesses avoid this is because it's beautifully complicated and messy, and it's not fixed and it changes every day. And all a business needs is to win a big contract or lose a big contract. And actually all of those stones dropping in all those ponds can change. The loss of somebody in a team, there's so many things that can change everything. But we've got some, if we know ourselves really well, there's lots of core things that sit true all the time. They're just affected in different ways. So the work you've been doing, Nigel, to help businesses know where to start with all of this is the thing, is that's the bit I find really interesting.
Yeah, and that's exercised the brain for quite some time, just trying to work out how do you actually assess how an organization is doing with all that stuff. And we've designed a what we call the HBLA 1, the Human Performance Leadership Assessment 1. Which is really a triage type assessment. So it's designed to sort of help an organization to say, well, roughly we're here. These are our hot spots and cold spots. These are the things that might be a weak signal of a future problem. These are things that are a difference in perception between teams or levels. Gives them all kinds of information about where their problems might already be or be likely to come from in the future to start to explore some of this stuff. Because your beautiful complexity point is well made here, I think, because one human being is incredibly complex. They are not complicated, but in the terms of Dave Snowden, the professor, talks about difference between complicated and complex. You know, complicated is multifaceted and loads of different moving parts, but somebody knows how to work it out. You know, my computer is complicated, my car engine is complicated, but there are people who are skilled in working that stuff out. Complex means no one knows how to work it out. And that's true for a human being, any of us that have ever been one. Know that we're very hard to work out. Anyone who's ever had a relationship knows that their partner is incredibly hard to work out. And if they have children, well, you know, all bets are off.
Forget about it.
Yeah. So bringing this back to the kind of where we started with this, these three interrelated areas, three, as we show them, three circles of behavior, capability, and well-being.
Mm.
Just taking those three things, there's so many factors that influence that stuff. So we choose to start in the beginning with the overall organization assessment, but then to look at the mental toughness and social and emotional intelligence part of leaders, because mm-hmm. we have found so far that they have the biggest impact on their behavior, capability, and the well-being of themselves and others.
Mm.
Taking Ronan's points, right, see that the way you show up and your own well-being is contagious for good and bad.
Mm.
If you were in a really foul mood and hating everything and everybody, you can recreate some of that around the organization ever so quick. One email can do it.
Mm.
Yeah, one really horrible email that's got no nice bits around the edges of it, or even just a misunderstood one, can cause mayhem, even in a big organization. You know, so the way you feel as a leader is reflected out into everybody else.
Mm.
You can be a stress dumper very quickly, a stress generator very quickly.
I find the assessment part really interesting, because often people look to an assessment to tell them what to do. So it's an answer. It's black and white. It's this means X, and therefore I must do that. Whereas actually, if we take even the psychometrics, not as fixed points, but as a snapshot of where you are typically at the moment, and then where might you choose to go next, depending on what you choose to develop and which path you follow, it allows all of this to be fluid. So as you say, people can get to know themselves better and work out where they want to start in order to develop themselves, so that they can then impact positively on others. And some of that's just knowing what frustrates you, or what limits you, or what challenges you. Actually, once you realize that this thing frustrates me and the behaviors I exhibit as a result are X and Y, and that's what other people are seeing and feeling, then you can start to go, okay, so let's go back to the root cause of these things. So it's not so much, particularly in the well-being world, so much is about the sticking plaster on the end of the bowl of fruit or the early finish on a Friday and all of those things. They're just sticking plasters over symptoms. We don't even know what they are. We don't know what the cause is of some of this feeling that other people have, which we go back to what's the root cause. And that's a complex path, but worth finding out. But it's the investment of time and energy of the biggest leadership team, so to speak, to say, this matters to us, and we're going to put time and energy into completing an assessment on how we perform as an organization. And then we're going to spend time over years, all of the years of the business existing, all of the time we're going to devote time to it. So every week forever, not we'll have 2 days off to do a course and then we'll come back and do business as usual. Because that's so often what we see, isn't it?
But I suppose what people listening to this might be thinking is are you talking about personal development, or are you talking about professional development? And where is the intersection there? And why should... A business is getting a bit too involved in people if they start thinking about, you know, their well-being and behaviours and things like that?
Yeah, that's a question. Of course, the correct answer to your question is yes. Yes, we're thinking about all of those things. And you could probably factor in organisational development into that pot too.
Mm.
So some of this is personal development in terms of people reflecting, being aware of how they are. I mean, you know, my mantra, my three things of know yourself, know your shadow, know how to adapt.
Mm.
My three-line mantra about what leadership is all about. Know yourself, know your shadow, know how to adapt. So know yourself is a reflective exercise, but also requires feedback from others, because you don't know yourself completely until somebody holds a mirror up to you. So that you could argue that's both personal and professional development, because it affects both of those things. And the kind of know your shadow is a bit about thinking, going back to Ronan's point about how do you show up and what effect does that have on people around you? When you, when something frustrates you, when you respond to that, what are you chucking into that particular pond that's rippling out? And of course, if we talk about the mental toughness bit, each person will react to those ripples in different ways. Some will be horrified, traumatized, upset by them. Others will just kind of stand on tiptoe a bit and let the wave go past, carry on, and not be affected by it at all. Do you know which is which? Do you know which ones are there? Do you know which one you are? Do you know whether you're going to be the one of the ones that can withstand those ripples, no trouble, or one of those ones that's going to drown the moment there's a 1-inch wave. And it's not anyone's fault which of those they are. It just is, but it can be shaped. It's a plastic personality trait. So you can, you know, mentoring and coaching can shift it. Self-coaching and reflection can shift it. Working together collegiately with colleagues and a team can shift it. That openness that Rona talked about, where people can start to talk to each other about the way they are. Mm. As we remember, we're talking about behavior, capability, well-being. Those are the three things. So how do I behave? What am I capable of? And how well am I?
Yeah.
How mentally strong and robust and resilient and capable am I?
Yeah.
And those three things, it's not easy. And this assessment we've talked about doesn't give people easy answers. It often raises more questions than it gives answers, but it does tell them what questions they should be asking themselves and each other in order to move it on.
Yeah.
Because it is, as Rona says, a lifelong journey.
And I suppose it formalizes a lot of things as well, in that, you know, a lot of what we're talking about in terms of the personal development, people might have been thinking to themselves for years, oh, I need to get better at this, and I need to behave better in these situations, and, you know, and I wish I didn't react in these certain ways. But what this does is, by bringing it into the organizational context, it formalizes it as part of the professional development. So you've got actual data that you can refer to, and you can learn, as you both mentioned, you can learn new things about yourself that you didn't realize and work on them in an organizational context.
And just imagine the impact on your wider life, because of course we're the same person that shows up at work, that shows up at home or in the community or with our families or wherever. So the more we know about ourselves, the more we're able to share it with all of the people in our lives and be a richer person, whatever that richness looks like. I think in the old days, it was you went to work and you were one person, and then you went home and you were someone else. And that an authentic leadership is about just being you all the time, which is really good for mental health and mental wealth, because it's far less exhausting to just be authentic. The challenge there, of course, is if you're putting up a mask to be able to cope in certain ways, whilst you might be able to wear that mask for certain periods of time, it will slip and fall to the detriment of your own well-being. So we want people to be able to be themselves and know themselves in their rich, glorious technicolor, and then work out, so what does that mean? How do we ensure that you are as capable and as well and behaving as effectively as possible in your biggest, widest life, not just in your work life?
And there's a phrase there that Nigel used as well, which I find very interesting: the mental wealth aspect of things, and as opposed to mental health.
Oh, that of Rona.
And I was going to say, Rona, you're a big proponent of this. Can you go into a little bit about exactly what the difference is?
I just think typically we think about mental health as something that can be seen. That feels quite negative. If I'm working on my mental health, it feels like there's a problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't see it that way. I see that we all want to be well physically and mentally. And most often we focus on the physical well-being. So we think about walking more, drinking more water, getting better sleep. So we're really thinking about what we're physically doing. But actually the reason we do those things is because it affects us mentally. So when we are well rested and well fed and well watered, we, just like plants, we perform much more happily and effectively. So if we think about that in its richest picture, so it's more than that. It's about the relationships we have. It's Nigel talked about the resilience that we have, our toughness, and actually what that is how we cope with uncertainty. So Sam Conliff's done some really interesting research that said that the next generation, their ability to cope with uncertainty will be the biggest predictor of success in the rest of their lives. And often what we do with particularly youngsters is we remove uncertainty, we remove danger and the unknown, because we think we're protecting them. But actually what we're doing is we're creating much greater problems in their futures, because they aren't resilient, because they've only known a single sensible, you know, safe track. And that's not what life is. Life is messy and complex. So in order to feel internally strong and happy and confident, we need to consider all those different facets more than drinking water and getting some exercise. As Nigel said before, they're really important. My life is full of sport, but that's not enough. There's so much more. And I think it's for everyone understanding what their drivers are. So when I used to teach sport, I always said to young people that there will be sports that you will continue for life. So my job in school is to show you as many as possible for you to work out which ones do you really enjoy doing and that you'll carry on in your life, because that will be important for your physical health and your mental health. And so what we're trying to do is help people to kind of create their own picture of what these, is it journaling? Is it certain foods? Is it certain types of activity? Which people that you surround yourselves with, where you spend your downtime, all of these different things. We're wanting to help people to understand what really fuels them so that mentally they feel strong and well, and that their mental wealth is kind of maximized.
I wonder, from a business perspective, I'm thinking about some of the jobs I've had in the past, and some of the, and a job where, which is, for example, sales heavy, where people might say, well, this, the type of job it is, the only thing I've got to motivate people is money, because otherwise they wouldn't do it. Well, is it still relevant in that area? Can they still use it in that area?
Yeah, so it's a very good question, and you're right. That's often the fallback position for those organizations. Think, well, this is a horrible job that everyone's going to hate. Therefore, we'll give them bribery and corruption, a bit of cash to kind of persuade them to do it. But it's not true, of course, because some people love that. Some people love doing that stuff. People are very fond of instant gratification, love the game. You know, you go to America, and the attitude of people in America to a sales interaction is so different to the way it is here.
Yeah.
Over there, people love it, and they love the game, and they love being sold to. Over here, if you were in a shop, that's increasingly unlikely these days, but if you were in a shop, and a sales assistant walked up to you and said, can I help you? The standard British response is, no, thanks, I'm just looking.
Yeah.
Even when you actually want to know something, just make them go away, because we don't
That's
trust
so
sales
neat.
People. So actually, I think there's a wider piece of thinking here about what is it that makes a job fun and attractive and enjoyable to do? See, even in those kinds, I don't know if you ever watched that documentary they did about the Welsh call centre. I've worked in a call centre, so it's easy to see that as a horrible job, but they were having a whale of a time, because it's just the way the people who were running it, the way they'd got it set up and the things they did. I worked for an organisation 30 odd years ago called Protocol Education Lecturing Services, and there were certain weeks of the year when it was absolute hell. We called them red weeks, where everything had to happen. And both Rona and I remember this time from our time in education, that there's always a period there where basically you have to put your life on hold because everything's going to go into a nightmare tailspin for the next few weeks. And then you come out alive, hopefully. And hopefully so do most of the other people as well. But the things we used to do in that organization, we used to have these doors that we took off of certain of the basement offices and stand them up around the room and put scores on them, scores on the doors. And it was somebody's job to go around throwing sweets at people for the whole of that 2 week period. They'd be pelting them with opal fruits and fruit jellies and chocolates, this kind of thing. And it was just a laugh. It was a riot, but it was great fun.
Right.
And people really enjoyed being there in those times. It took something that could have been horrible and made it a laugh.
Right. So there's always something you can find that.
Yeah. And that's down to leaders again. See, if leaders are obsessed with data and spreadsheets and, ticking things off a list, they generate a certain type of response, which can be helpful in some circumstances, but not if I'm there, because I can't do that. I don't do things in a straight line. It's not mentally possible for me. I have to go off at tangents, as you've seen and heard. But if people view life as a human experience, the work is just part of life. Going back to Rona's point, this is not a separate life. This is just one part of your life. Therefore, why would you not want to apply the same logic and rules and expectations and thinking to that bit of your life? It's a big chunk, after all. But that leaders can have such an impact on that. So leaders' behavior and capability has a massive effect on people's well-being right there, in terms of the climate and environment and culture they create.
Yeah, and for leaders to also spot when people are in the wrong place, in the wrong job. I remember having in my very first job, working with a colleague who's a languages teacher, and she was a phenomenal languages teacher, and she was in completely the wrong school. And so the response of the children wasn't positive because they didn't warm to her style and her way of teaching. She moved to another school and absolutely flew. And so sometimes it is around knowing yourself and also knowing other people, knowing what the job entails and working out how well matched they are. I remember doing, I did a year ago to now, I did a psychometric as part of the board work that I do. So with Zest Theatre Company, we did a psychometric for everybody on the board so we could get to know ourselves a little bit better and see how other people show up, because we're all remote, we're all around the world. We're always online. How can we be really effective together? And actually what that psychometric reminded me was of the kind of circumstances under which I thrive. And it was part of the reason I decided to leave the job I was in. It's because whilst it was a really interesting job and I worked with great people, actually it wasn't right for me. And so that was about making a decision about where was the best place for me to be for my career so that I could be authentically me and not trying to be something else. So leaders have the responsibility for creating the conditions, but also for helping people to check that they're in the right place.
That was something I was going to ask about, you know, how can it be done in this modern world where a lot of stuff is done remotely and you can't lob an opal fruit at someone across the room. You know, how can we do, and I suppose that's, you've answered that question by pointing out that diagnostics are a way, by getting some data, by asking the questions are the way of finding out.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that the diagnostic of that nature has ended up being the responsibility of HR. And it's not an HR tool. Yeah, okay, if you're going to use it as part of recruitment, there's a certain logic for it being there. But this is something that people have to own for themselves. Now, I've railed against this for years. You know, when you go to, back in my days in education, you know, college would send these things out to every shortlisted candidate for any job. And then only one of those people would, at most, would get that job. And this stuff would all get filed.
Yeah.
Nobody ever looked at it ever again. And yet that's crucial information about, for that person and for the people who are working with that person, about how they're going to work effectively together.
Yeah.
And your point about, you know, the job not being right for you, that also shifts, doesn't it, over time?
Yeah.
If something's right for you this year, it might not be right for you next year. And you've got to have the awareness, know yourself, know your shadow, know how to adapt. You've got to, that's part of adaptation, is to think, well, actually, my best version of me requires me to be able to do these things. I'm only doing two of those seven things in this current job. So either I've got to shape that job so I can do more of them, or I need to find one that ticks more of those particular boxes of my capabilities and my triggers.
And then equally put that in the middle of the rest of your life, because often it's what's happening in the rest of our lives that also has an impact on the direction we're going in, the type of role we want to do, or the way we've developed as individuals. And it's that constant, because we constantly evolve. Actually, our requirements from life are constantly evolving. But there can be just a tendency to see jobs as a series of actions that need to be completed, rather than the people that we work with as being people, and us getting to know one another to work out how we're going to work most effectively and happily together. Because if we can work happily together, we'll be effective. Yeah. If we can't, we won't. And you need to know people, you need to have some fun. So Matt, back to your point of it being kind of online and remote, it's really easy just to create meetings that start and end and are 60 minutes long, and it's all about the meeting rather than the conversations at the start and middle and end that make it a conversation rather than a meeting, because we have to get time with people. And when I've run programs online for how to work with people remotely, we talk about having fun, and I then can see people scheduling fun in. We'll have a 10-minute fun bit here, and then we'll stop that shenanigans and we'll do the real stuff. And it's just allowing a little bit of freedom, I think, makes a big difference. But
yes,
as ever, it's always complicated.
It is, yeah. Our associate, Lisa Avery, you know, is the positive psychologist, and she talks about this, that playfulness has such an important part to play in people's well-being, their behavior, the climate and culture, that if you're not in the sort of organization where it's okay to do something just for fun, you're probably in the wrong organization. Because that's going to, if you're the sort of person that recognizes the need for that, you're not going to find it. You see more modern organizations in particular fields, and people talk about things like beanbags and all that kind of stuff, but they're just symbolic of a different attitude, a different mindset, that they recognize that people need to have a good time. Mm. That need to, if you can't find some space to enjoy yourself, then what the hell are you doing for the 50 years of your working life?
Yeah.
Bad. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, I think we've talked a lot about that. And if I was to think about some of the things that we've touched on, I mean, obviously, we've said that human performance is about a lot more than just capability. Mm. And from our point of view, we look at it in the three circles of capability, well-being, and behavior. And then if you are going to start looking at that in your people, you need to look at yourself first. Mm. Look at yourself and think about yourself in those three lenses. But then when you do that, make sure you ask others as well, because you could learn something. You could learn something surprising about yourself that you really didn't understand. And then, in terms of businesses which maybe have work which rely on sort of financial incentives to inspire people, find the way that you can concentrate on people and their well-being, because there will be. Mm. And then, from a remote point of view. If you are working remotely with your team and it's difficult to pick up on the social cues that we have traditionally relied on, make sure you ask those questions. Use data, essentially, which sounds a bit cold, but essentially, if you don't ask the question, you're not going to find out. Mm. Is there anything else I've missed?
I think probably the one thing I would say for people is that this is all stuff that is scientifically proven and measurable. It might not sound as if it is, but somebody's mental toughness can be measured. You can therefore see how it changes over time through specific interactions like coaching and mentoring, or just their own reflection or their conversations they have with other people. So you can actually gather real insight into where you are, where you want to go, and how it's going. Mm. It's not just a wet finger in the wind or a bit of, you know, a tarot reading. It's a bit more to it than that. This is based around people's brain functions. You can track it.
And you're right, that is important to say, because people do just naturally think, well, yeah, skills can be measured, skills can be improved. But this is what we're talking about is exactly the same as well, yeah, isn't it?
Certainly. And far more significant, generally speaking. Mm. I've worked with lots of people who had a great deal of skill. In fact, I remember a conversation with my chairman going back many years ago. And I said to him about the person that I was trying to lobby for this person to have opportunities. And I said, but look at him. He's got so many skills. And he turned to me and said, yes, what a pity they're in him. And I thought, ooh, yeah, you've got a point there. The guy was not somebody that people found easy to work with, or right, intended to cause ripples of an unhelpful sort. And so he did have all those skills. It's great. But unfortunately, they lived inside a grenade where the pin was just about to fall out.
Wow.
I was only in my 20s then. I hadn't really thought about that stuff before, but it was an epiphany for me.
Hmm. Okay, great. Well, let's leave it there. Thanks a lot for your time this week, guys, and we'll see you all next week.
Thanks, then.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Leadership Learned podcast. If you would like to learn more about human performance leadership, Nigel has written a blog summarising a lot of what we talked about in the podcast, and you can find a link to it in the show notes. If you enjoyed the podcast, please do subscribe. We'd love to hear your thoughts about the themes discussed today. You can find us on LinkedIn by searching Inspirational Development Group, or you can email us on info@inspirationaldg.com. If you'd like to learn more about IDG and the work we do optimizing human performance through leadership development, you can find us at www.inspirationaldevelopment.com. We'll see you next time.